Our panelists this afternoon, and I'll ask them to come up now and join us if they don't mind. We're very excited about this session in business, economics, and international trade. It's between Canada and the U.S. And our panelists are all senior executives of companies that are Canadian world champions. For example, Sean Finn is the executive vice president of CN. Railway has nearly 40% of its activities in the United States. He's got a map there to show you the T of North America, his T-shape. And the largest single shareholder in the company is a computer geek named Bill Gates, who has 10% of the equity in CN. A major player in the United States as well as Canada. Alvin Siegel is the chairman of Peerless, the world's largest manufacturer of clothing for men. If you buy a Calvin or a Ralph at Macy's in New York, it's made here in Montreal or at other Peerless plants around North America. Frank McKenna, the former premier of New Brunswick and now vice chair of TD Bank, TD Financial Group. TD is now the largest retail bank in the U.S. Northeast. Is that right, Frank?
Uh-huh.
When you go to Boston and see the Bruins, you're in the TD Center. When you go to Times Square, you see a big TD map. When you go to Washington, TD is right across from the White House. They're everywhere in the U.S., so that's a great story. And our moderator, also a former ambassador to the U.S., as Frank was, is Derek Burney, who, when he was now with Ogilvy Renault, but when he's in the private sector at CAE here in Montreal, listen to this. CAE alone produces 75% of the world's civil aviation flight simulators. So these are great Canadian success stories of people who can make it in America and make it anywhere. And Derek is going to take us through a conversation that we're really excited about. Derek?
Thank you very much, Ian. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I particularly appreciated the plug the Governor General gave yesterday to CAE. I thought that was quite remarkable, and I've told them to put it on their website and get it out in all the ads they've got and make sure they invite them to fly a simulator very soon at our plant here in Montreal. Well, Ian has stolen my thunder in terms of introducing our distinguished panel. You heard this morning from others that good news doesn't really register very often in Washington. So we've got this panel here just to give you some snapshots of genuine good news about Canadian companies that are doing well in the United States. And you may not have heard very much about it, and the reason is, as you heard this morning, that we don't get publicity for good news. We are very pleased to have them. What I'd like to do is I'd like to invite them to speak in two different directions. First of all, I think it's important for each of you to hear a snapshot from each of them of what it is they're doing in the United States and how it was that they came to be as successful as they have been with their respective enterprises. And then when we finish that, I'm going to tailor the questioning a little more directly to whatever they might see as some of the obstacles today to the businesses that they're attempting to achieve, especially in light of the recent Beyond the Border Declaration and whether it can help resolve some of the thickening of the border that they may have run into. Although if you're running a railroad or a bank, I think the border is probably a little less of an impediment. In any event, I'm going to start at the far right with Sean Finn. That's the alphabetical way for a good diplomat to begin, and work our way this way, and then we'll go back for the second round in reverse order. So, Sean, over to you. Tell us all about CNN. You even got a map, so we exactly know where you are in the U.S., but go from there.
Isn't Alvin before Sean? No, I guess not.
You're first.
Thanks, Alvin. Can we put the map up? And yes, you can't talk about a railway without a map, so hopefully... It's up there now, yeah. Maybe a few words about CN very quickly and where we've come from in the last couple of years. We were a federal crown corporation for almost 90 years. In 1995, we were privatized by the Government of Canada. At the time, the biggest IPO in the history of Canada. To give you an idea, the market cap of our company in November of 95 was $2.5 billion. Today, it's $32.9 billion. And a big portion of that is thanks to the NAFTA strategy, plus our strategy expanding to the U.S., We stand today with 22,000 employees in North America, And we call ourselves North America's Railway, obviously. Route miles, 20,000 route miles, revenues of $8.2 billion, was about $2.8 billion in 1995. Our transporter traffic is $2 billion a year, almost a third of our revenue. On a daily basis, 3,000 rail cars go across the border going either south or coming north. And finally, the market cap is $32.9 billion. If you look at the footprint, prior to 95, this map would have shown you a network going from Prince Rupert and Vancouver to just to Chicago, a very modest dip into the U.S., and then from Chicago to Halifax. At that time, CN was owned the Grand Trunk Railway, probably one of the oldest railways in North America. And as we were prior to 1995, our then CEO, Paul Tellier, who was one of the architects of the free trade agreement, understood clearly that the growth was going to come from no longer east-west traffic flows, but north-south. So we proceeded to buy a railway that went from Chicago to New Orleans called the Illinois Central Railway in 1998, which was our really first attempt to expand into the U.S. But in the last 10 years, we've done $8 billion of U.S. acquisitions. We've integrated railways in the U.S., and you think integrating cultures is difficult. In our industry, very much so. As much as we said to you yesterday, I guess the automobiles are U.S. culture. Railways were created in the U.S., so you can imagine trying to create U.S. railways. We bought IC. We very much acquired one of the first land-grant railways. IC was an icon in the U.S. CN, we hope, was an icon in Canada, bringing together two great companies. IC was such an icon that its lawyer was Abraham Lincoln. So Abraham Lincoln won a tax case for IC before he was president, dealing with the right for the state of Illinois to tax railways. And when we announced the deal, Paul Tellier said, you know, IC is such an icon that Abraham Lincoln was the lawyer for IC. The week after, I gave Paul Abraham Lincoln's bio and explained to him, yes, he did do work for us, but we didn't pay his bill. He had to sue us, and he took the money to go to Washington with his wife and visit Niagara Falls. So that was probably a big success, our acquisition of IC. We inquired with that railway, not just an outstanding railway to New Orleans, but also Hunter Harrison, who was an iconic railroader who can operate the railway in the back of his mind, was our CEO until last year. And really leverage Paul Tellier's NAFTA strategy to really get into the U.S. and ensure that we had a very strong presence and a strong railway to operate in the U.S. It's not always been successful. In 1999, we tried to acquire BNSF, Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway, which today is owned by Warren Buffett, at which time the U.S. regulators decided that it was a premature probably to let a Canadian company buy a huge U.S. railway. And very quickly, Washington ensured through regulatory maneuvers to change the rules of the deal in the middle of the game and effectively turn down our deal. But in retrospect, I think that we've done well without BNSF, and we wish Mr. Buffett good luck with his railway. No doubt it's an outstanding railway, but it just shows you that there are moments in time where you look at acquiring in the U.S., you think you're ready for it, but we probably have not prepared the terrain like we should have. A few words about recent acquisitions. You probably saw a lot in the media the last year and a half. We bought a very small railway outside of Chicago called the EJ&E, and the purpose was to bypass downtown Chicago and move traffic out to the suburbs. We didn't figure out that the suburbs were very wealthy suburbs and did not want to have additional trains in Barrington, Illinois, which is the hometown of Secretary Paulson, at which time we did the acquisition. The senator from Illinois was Senator Obama with Senator Dick Durbin, and the chief of staff of the president at that time was Rahm Emanuel, who's now the mayor of Chicago. So even though we were prepared for the acquisition, we underestimated the opposition of the local communities. So it took a lot more work than we wanted to. It took us 2 years, but we now own the railway. And this will show you the importance for Canadians to understand that all politics are local, as we all know. We entered into 27 agreements with 32 towns along the EJ&E to mitigate our impact on our communities. If it weren't for that, we wouldn't own the railway today. So I guess one lesson learned is the importance for us as Canadians when we decide to invest in the U.S., to very much walk in their shoes, understand their issues, and not think we can solve them from downtown Montreal or Ottawa. You have to solve them locally.
That's what gives good works for diplomats, though, as Frank and I will attest, you know, working through problems like that.
No, that's it, Derek. I'll talk about the border later.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sean. You know, this morning we heard about the metaphor of the teenage girl and the football player. My favorite metaphor about the relationship comes from a movie called Protocol, in which Goldie Hawn was being interviewed for the job of a protocol officer in the State Department, and they asked her, well, have you ever traveled to any foreign countries? And she said, no. Well, I went to Canada once, but it's kind of attached, isn't it? Well, I think what Sean's map shows you is that we are kind of attached. And you heard many times this morning about the confusion Americans sometimes have about regarding us as foreigners. But unfortunately, when they legislate, we're all foreigners, and that's the bane of the existence of our ambassadors in Washington in trying to get around that. Alvin, you heard the story as well this morning that when Ian came to our embassy in Washington in 1991 and there was a story about Peerless in the New York Times that he wanted to celebrate across the country, I said, no bloody way. The last thing I want is a lot of publicity about all the suits that we're selling in the United States. But you're the guy that's done it, and please tell us how and what it is you're doing in the United States.
Well, Peerless is a private company. Family business, and 92 years old. We started in 1919. Ups and downs all the way. In 1989-90, the bank closed me. The bank sent me a letter, find a new bank. Thank God. Free trade, the FTA, came just the right time. And I was involved. I was ready for it. Peerless was ready. We knew it was coming. We had a new building on Pinot in Montreal. And until 1990, I'd been trying to get into the U.S. market. But the barriers, the tariffs, wouldn't let me. I'd take two steps forward, one step back, three steps back. Free trade hit. Immediately, we formed a U.S. company because Americans don't want to be seen as buying from a foreigner. So we have opened a sales office in New York, all American salesmen, and we opened a warehouse in St. Albans, Vermont. So we send goods from Montreal factory to St. Albans, and we sell U.S. dollars, FOB, St. Albans, Vermont. We're seen as a U.S. company. I want to say, first of all, I want to clarify, I'm in the apparel industry, not the textile industry. I've spent my entire life in Ottawa trying to get people to understand that historically, apparel was called textiles. We certainly need textiles, but men's suits, men's fine clothing, we call it, tailored suits, we don't make textiles. We buy textiles globally, and we cut and sew them here in Montreal at the beginning. Now we're the markets forced us to go the Orient, so on. Government makes the plan. The government, NAFTA, the government makes the rules. We follow the rules. It's true that in 89-90, no one knew. There were winners, there were losers about to happen. I wanted to be a winner, and we are. So we're growing right now. We're importing. We still have a factory in Montreal, employ over 1,000 people. We have a warehouse in St. Albans with 400 people. A sales office in New York. We're seen as a U.S. company. I see most of the men here are wearing tailored suits. A lot of them were sold by Peerless. With it's Ralph Lauren, Calvin Klein, Donna Karan, Michael Kors, lots of labels. I'm not selling now.
You could have fooled me.
Call me afterwards. So that's where we are today, enjoying a good year right now. In fact, our half year ends next week, the end of March, and we're enjoying good times. And all my competitors seem to be going out of business. I don't know why. But
now we know why you're smiling. And like a good salesman, have you noticed he hasn't mentioned a single number?
No numbers.
Thank you, Alvin.
Frank, tell us about TD.
Well, yeah, to start with, Derek, thanks for having me today. And with two extraordinary people like Sean and Alvin here, the story is just mesmerizing. And Derek, you're a great national treasure in your own right. So it's very flattering to be with you. I appreciate
it. Thank you. The
TD story is pretty simple. I don't think it's been under the radar screen very much. We're now a big North American bank. We actually have more branches in the United States than we do in Canada. We have 1,300 branches in the United States.
Wow.
We've publicly forecast we'll be taking $1.6 billion out of just retail banking in the United States by 2013. We started acquiring in 2005. We bought TD Bank North 51%. 2 years later, we bought the rest of it. Same year, Commerce Bancorp became available as a result of some regulatory issues. And that became a transformational deal for us because it was a superb bank that was a mirror image of the service and convenience value proposition of TD on this side of the border. So that really got us going. And then when the downturn hit in the United States, we had a strong balance sheet and we weren't in trouble. So we actually were asked by U.S. authorities to look at some of their institutions. And we bought Riverside in Florida and two other Florida banks and South Financial Group later in South Carolina. So all of that has come together beautifully to create a great branch network and a good earnings platform. And just a couple of weeks ago, we added Chrysler Financial to that. It was about a $6 billion acquisition. South Financial, Chrysler Financial is a perfect fit for us because we, in the Canadian side of the border, we match up our deposits and our assets almost perfectly. But in the United States, we have a deposit-taking machine in our branch network, and so we have a big mismatch. We don't have enough really profitable things to put our money into, so some of them go into treasuries earning low rates of return. But the auto leasing business is a very lucrative business with high margins, and the book that Chrysler was running before they got in trouble some years ago is up to $75 billion. So we'll create a big book of auto loans in the United States, and it'll help create profits out of our deposit base. So that's kind of the story. It's I think it's getting well accepted in the United States now. We don't go down there as Toronto Dominion. We're TD, and we're labeled everywhere. We've transformed all of our networks into TD products. And just to tell you how far we've come, last year we had a funny situation. We have a cruise ship terminal in St. John, New Brunswick, and a lot of American cruise ships pull in. And we have a TD branch right in front of it. And our branch manager was out walking one day and overheard two passengers get off, and one turned to the other and say, "See, I told you so. They even have TD up here in Canada." So we've come a long way.
Well, you have Mr. Law and Order as your pitchman.
We see him
on TV all the time with the TD product, right?
That's the Ameritrade side of the house where TD Ameritrade is the biggest discount broker in the world by trades, and we own controlling interest in that. And we have Kelly and Reed just pitching for us.
Oh, yeah, well, you got them all.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, many of the investors in the room know all about Ameritrade, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Before we talk about the border and the beyond the border work plan, I guess there was a question I wanted to ask the three of you, given what you've already said. And it came up a bit earlier this morning. The question of culture. I mean, in running your businesses in Canada and the United States, and the three of you have indicated that you've got substantial employment in branches, in the United States. Is there a big difference in the culture of the employees on each side of the border? And if so, what is it? And how do you manage that as a, you know, a global operation? I'll start with you, Frank, if I may.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, a cultural question. And as Canadians, we
don't have a culture, right?
Not really. We have a lot of cultures. By the way, this is probably the most important event that's taking place today in Canada. <Don't you think?
laughs> Spoken like a true liberal.
No, easily, it's easily the most important thing. But it's funny, you know. We do have it's almost a smugness, but we do think certain things about ourselves. We think we're really nice people, yeah. Really friendly, neighborly, and
especially our bankers.
Yeah, that's our bankers. We're really, but you know, the banks that we bought in the United States, the service they give was better than ours, and the people were nicer than we were, and they've blown us away with how aggressive they are on their service and convenience. And
interesting.
So instead of us kind of running into the stereotype of the more distant American, I guess you could say, what we found was just the opposite. Hmm. Just superb people who have, by cross-fertilization, introduced extraordinary skills back into the Canadian operations.
Interesting. Alvin, is there a big jump from Montreal to St. Albans?
1 hour, depending on U.S.
border. We'll come back to that.
But when we free trade started in 89, January 1st, I'll never forget it. We had a Canadian sales force, and we hired an American sales force. We had two separate lines. Quickly, I realized, why do we have two lines? We now have, and we immediately started having one line, we show suit samples every season. Our Canadian salesmen quickly agreed. And we now, so culturally, as far as men's styles are concerned, we show men, thank God I'm in the men's suit business, not the women's business.
No. Don't go too far there.
That's a whole other world. But we show 500 samples every season. The winner every season, every year, plain black, plain navy, whether you're on Canada or the U.S.
Look at the front.
That's why I'm wearing gray.
You stand out.
So culturally, as far as the fashion business, we're one country, North America.
Okay. Sean.
Yeah, I guess I would say to you, we probably have four cultures in the U.S. and probably five in Canada within the company. But two little stories I'll tell you. When we acquired Illinois Central Railway, our CEO was Paul Tellier, who's from Joliette, Quebec. His English is very, very good, but a wee bit of an accent. Hunter Harrison was the CEO of IC. He's from Memphis, Tennessee. Was born down the street from Memphis, from Elvis, I mean, excuse me. He doesn't speak French, and some would say he doesn't speak English. But they sat down and negotiated a deal here in Montreal, and perfect example, a southerner from Memphis and a little boy from Joliette negotiating a deal, but brought together two great companies and very quickly focused on the positive side, not the negative side. Then Hunter was the CEO when he bought BC Rail. So BC Rail was a provincially owned Crown corporation, very much like CN, but a bit more probably to the left than CN was probably at this time. I remember Hunter in the acquisition, he would sit in his office in Chicago or in Montreal, and he'd be reading the Prince Rupert Citizen. And he thought it was a Chicago Tribune. He thought it was the same size of circulation. And in that paper one morning, they said there had been a survey. And in this article, it said that 10% of Canadians do not like Americans. And being in charge of public affairs, he calls me up and he says, Sean, did you read this? Can you believe that? 10% of Canadians do not like Americans. I said, Hunter, take a Valium. 20% of Canadians don't like Canadians.
And that's only the ones in Prince Rupert. Yeah.
So then I think, but I must say, one of our strengths at CN is we don't walk into our offices in Jackson, Mississippi, or Montreal, or Toronto with our passports. Look at today at CN. We have a CEO who's Claude Mongeau from Montreal. Our CFO is in Montreal. I'm here. Our chief operating officer is Keith Creel. He's in Chicago. But very unique. That railway, if you look at it, our center of operations in the U.S. is in Chicago. The guy who runs Chicago, all of the U.S., his name is Jim Venna. He's a Canadian from Jasper. The guy who runs the whole eastern division of CN operations is in Toronto. He's from Jackson, Mississippi. So you can imagine that for us, culture is a challenge, more a challenge to change a Crown Corporation culture than to bring together, you know, a North American culture. And our secret of success has been to always try and go to the highest standard, be it in corporate governance, be it in operations, be it in safety. So you have to have rules and regulations in Canada, the U.S., and you always inspire your people to go to the highest standards, then culture becomes being the best, becomes a culture of excellence. And it's not an issue in Canada or U.S. to be the best. That's not hard to be.
Thanks very much. Okay, well, let's, if we can, turn to the current work plan on the border to try to remove some of the obstacles that are there in the name of security. You're all aware of the declaration that came out a month ago. As I understand it, there are two separate exercises underway. One is to address the issues of the border, moving things away from the border as much as possible. And then there's a separate exercise intended to address all the regulatory mishmash that companies face on both sides, where we have a lot of regulations that are different just for the sake of being different. My classic is the anti-theft immobilization device on automobiles. Do you realize that in Canada you have to have them on every car that's manufactured, whereas in the United States it's only on the top-end models? And that's for the North American automobile companies like GM, Ford, and Chrysler, of which the government is a major owner. But don't get me going on that one. And you represent very different kinds of industries, and I'm sure that whatever problems you confront are perhaps unique to your own business. But I'd like to draw you out a little bit on whether you think this is a worthwhile undertaking on the part of the two governments. If you say no, you can leave the stage now. What would you like to see come out of the exercise in terms of how it would boost your business in the United States? And I'll start down at the end with you again, Sean, if I may.
Now, this is going to be a bit self-serving, obviously, but if you look at that map...
That's what this is all about.
Yes. If you look at that map again, you can probably imagine by sitting back and saying, what is CN's strategy for growth? And one of our growth strategies is for our ports of Rupert, which is a closer sailing to Vancouver or to Seattle to Asia, for the ports of Rupert, Vancouver, and Halifax to be the gateway to North America. Don't tell our U.S. colleagues, but that's the strategy.
Is it true, if I may just ask you on that, is it true that to ship from, say, Japan via Prince Rupert instead of Seattle or Los Angeles to get something to Chicago, you shave 2 days off it?
Two days, and then we can move a boxcar, hopefully, or a container out of Rupert to Chicago or Memphis quicker than you can get it off a ship either in Vancouver some weeks or in Seattle. But the strategy is to do so. So we're essentially selling our service in Asia and Europe, and it won't take somebody in Asia very quickly to look at this and say, well, that's pretty good. We can pick Rupert, Vancouver, Halifax, lots of capacity. We can get to markets quicker. But what about this thing called the border? So our challenge is to explain to our customers around the world that the border is an issue, but it can be managed. And I guess we're very fortunate in our industry. 45% of all freight that goes to Canada, U.S. goes over by on a railway. And we don't know this today, but every single container or boxcar that goes over the Canada, U.S. border goes through an X-ray machine. Every single container, 100%. Versus trucks, we're lucky if it's 5%, maybe 4%. And to show you how I think that even though we've been very challenged with the border, our U.S. Friends have understood the importance of making sure that we can get goods across that border. There's a tunnel now today between Sarnia, Ontario, and Port Huron. It used to be called the St. Clair Tunnel. Now it's called the Paul M. Tellier Tunnel. And that tunnel has a certain grade coming out. And as they decided to move the essentially vacus machines, X-ray machines, to the border, obviously our colleagues in the U.S. would put the vacus machine on the U.S. side. We had to explain to them that if the grade of the tunnel is such, if the train is going less than 10 miles an hour, it'll back into the tunnel to Canada. And to X-ray a Vacus machine, you have to go through it 3 miles an hour. So we said, this is a big problem, because you move it far from the border. And surprisingly, we convinced U.S. Customs and Border Agency to put the Vacus machine on the Canadian side of the border.
Hmm.
So U.S. Customs X-rays, you know, every container going through the Politelia Tunnel on the Sarnia side.
Yeah. Yeah.
An example of how you have to work with them. But to answer your question directly, Derek, there's not a day that we go by where we're not worried about that border. I mean, there's nobody in our function, our company, day in, day out, we watch it as a hawk because it's so important to our business. But I think that the secret is, we said a bit about this morning, it's all about the personal relationships. We can go to Ottawa, we can go to Washington and try and explain how safe we are, how we make sure that there's nobody in our boxcars or in our grain cars. We put grain in our grain cars, not people. And when the Vacus machine goes off, it's usually because a smoke detector has a bit of radiation in it, and therefore it's not some illegal equipment going to the U.S. But that's got to be done, again, on a local basis. So we have an initiative at CN where all of our people are asked to get to know their local border agent, both Canada and U.S., because that's where the trouble starts and that's where you solve your problems. So I think that moving the perimeter outside of the border would be great for Canada. No doubt it would be great for our strategy being a North American gateway to North America. But at the same time, we recognize that there will always be a need to make sure there's a check and balance in the system at that border. And it's our job as Canadians, or in some cases, U.S. companies going transborder, to make sure that we meet the requirements, we share the information, and we work together. Because the day that we decide we're not going to share the information or work together, that border will get so thick that we won't know what to do.
But, Sean, is it possible that in addition to what you've already done at the tunnel, by moving the X-ray machine onto the Canadian side, you know, since part of the concept, as I understand it, of the border declaration is to move cargo clearance as far away from the border as possible, I mean, do you see some potential whereby, say, something's coming into Vancouver but is not off, or Prince Rupert, and is going straight to the United States, is it possible to have it cleared in Prince Rupert? And then is there that potential if we can come to the right agreement on it?
Sure, and I think there's already been some inroads. There are U.S. Customs agents on the ground in Halifax and in Vancouver that
sure
pre-clear equipment coming from, or goods coming from Europe, because that's clear a second time at the border. But I think that that'll require that we can ensure that as the goods go from Halifax or Vancouver and transit through Winnipeg or Toronto, that in those yards, we have the same level of security that we need to get across the border. I think that's the secret. And to say, well, you just clear it once and we can move across the border, it won't be an issue. But clearly, it sounds like a new idea, but I think it's already in the workings, and it won't take a big jump for us to go one step further as long as we work in good faith with our U.S. colleagues and understand that to them, security is important, and it's part of doing business.
And the technology is there.
Exactly.
Well, your point about the importance of personalities reminds me, Frank, in my time in Washington, we were having an awful problem with an inspector, an agriculture inspector in Montana, who kept stopping all the trucks bringing pork and beef across the border. So the way to get around it was I invited them to our Canada Day party at the embassy where we were flipping hamburgers and serving them to the Americans,
yeah.
And he came. We didn't have a problem. It was amazing. Alvin, from your perspective, how much of an impediment is the border? What sort of improvements would make life a little easier and better for Peerless if this exercise gets some traction?
Well, first of all, the apparel industry, certainly the men's suit industry, is extremely competitive. And customer service is our middle name. When Macy's or anyone buys, they want delivery 24 hours. Now, if it's produced in Montreal, we have a good broker, get yourself a good forwarder. He's in the room right now, Delmar. Get you a good forwarder.
No.
I'm not allowed to say that, but I said it.
Well, you did.
And Alvin, you need a good railway.
Okay.
And don't forget your bank.
I'm sorry. But customer service, the easier we make the border. Right now, we have pretty good service. We have trucks going every day, Montreal, St. Albans. Pretty good. It can always be better, but the easier you make it, eventually, hopefully, like Brian Rooney said last night. I love that idea. In Europe, when you travel country to country, you flash your passport, you're way through. We still have a border, but we're one country, in my mind, and our industry, we're one country. I know we're a sovereign country. I don't want to step out of line here, but we're all the same.
And but would the pre-clearance arrangement of some kind expedite matters for you if they could back up and seal the truck shipment in Montreal and then with that certificate go right through the border? Wouldn't that be?
It works like that usually.
Oh, it does.
Yes. If you follow the right system, follow the law, have a good reputation, U.S. Customs, they spot check. But they know we're doing it for years. It can always be improved, but it's pretty good right now.
One of the things, though, you said to me last night, which I wanted to ask the three of you about, was how important in the free trade negotiations in NAFTA, the sector advisory groups that we had, the SAGITs on international trade. I mean, the negotiators couldn't have done what they did without the advice of the private sector that they were trying to serve. I've never understood why those were abandoned not long after, and they, as far as I know, they're not using that sort of advisory council for the European negotiations or the Doha negotiations, for that matter. I mean, you, I know, were very much part of that advisory process back in the 80s. Wouldn't there be some merit if they expect this work plan to get some traction? Wouldn't there be merit in getting something similar to that so they're actually talking to the people who have a vested interest in getting a good result? Wouldn't you?
Right now, you're right. That's where I learned when my first SAGIT meeting back in the 80s, I did not know what a quota meant, what the word import, export, I knew nothing. I learned from the negotiators and other people in the industry. And sure, it would be a good idea to continue SAGIT, stay involved with government. I have Elliot Lifson. Can I plug Elliot?
Because stand up, Elliot.
Wherever you are.
There he is. He's got some students with him, too.
A lot of you students in the room attend Elliot's class. He's my full-time public relations advisor. He does a great job. He's in Ottawa. He's all over the place, trying to make things easier and better.
Okay, Alvin, anybody else in the family you want to introduce before we move along here? Frank, how can the government make your business better in the U.S.?
Well, there are a lot of things the government could do to make our life better in the United States, but it's not because we're Canadians. It's because we're part of a group of banks, 8,000 in the United States, who have quite rightfully tripped some very important tripwires over the last several years. And as a result of that, the regulatory environment in the United States is intensely complicated. But not because we're a Canadian bank.
No.
Just because we're...
Bad banks.
Bad banks. Those other bad banks have got us
before
a lot of trouble.
Before you bought them.
Yeah. So we don't have... The border's not a major problem. I could give you a few irritants, but generally that's not the problem. Canada, basically, you want to... If you have a problem, you call the head of OSFI, you call the governor of the bank, you call the minister of finance, and everything is kind of done. In the United States, we go through... the FDIC, we go through the OCC, we deal with community reinvestment organizations, we deal with the New York Fed, the Philadelphia Fed, the Atlanta Fed. We have to deal with an alphabet soup of regulatory agents, now a new financial consumer agency. We have to deal with all of the state people as well on top of that. And then we have to deal, of course, with Dodd-Frank Volcker Amendment, Collins Amendment. We have to deal with Reg E. We have to deal with Durbin Amendment. So we just have a nightmare of rules and regulations, all appropriate in their own way.
And not exclusive to Canada.
But not exclusive to us. No. Bottom line is that we're not being picked on. So we just have to deal with that. It's more complicated, but those are the rules of the game.
But I presume if we can make the border more fluid, that's going to be good for the bank, because even though it may not be directly affecting you, it's affecting your clients.
No doubt about that. Just allowing people to go back and forth, including our employees, more easily.
Right.
NAFTA passports.
Right.
Or just small little things. It's almost impossible for us to be able to maneuver through all of the bureaucracy to allow Canadians to open Canadian dollar accounts in the U.S. and vice versa.
Right.
Things like that that should be much easier than they are. But these are fairly small things. I would say there aren't major impediments to us doing business in the United States.
Okay.
That would make us feel like we're being singled out.
Okay, we're going to throw it open to Adam and some questions from the web. You're not allowing questions from the floor? Well, okay, so any of you in the audience who have questions, please get yourself to a microphone. But Adam, if you're traditional place, I'll call on you now.
We have a question from Jean-Luc in Montreal, who asks, what remain the major barriers to Canadian economic activity in the U.S.? How would you rate the ease of business transfers across the border before and after 9/11?
Sean, do you want to take a crack at that first?
Yeah, I think that, again, our industry is very very fortunate, very unique. No doubt there was a tightening of the border on and around September 11th. But I think it quickly, because of the fact that both the U.S. government and Canadian government would work with the private sector, made us one of the first partners on the Smart Border Initiative. Again, I think that it took us a while to make sure we understood what was important here. But I think that because of the nature of our business, we are tied to the ground. We know what's going to go on the boxcar, hopefully, because it goes across the border. I think it's worked out well. Now, it's not like that for everybody. There are challenges. I mean, we'll get the situations like big difference would be very rarely prior to September 11th would a train get stopped at the border. Once you stop trains at the border, if a train is 10,000 feet long and the siding at the border is 6,000 feet long, you got a problem. You got 4,000 feet sticking out of the back of the siding, and often we're not equipped to unpack or de-stuff containers or boxcars. So that was a big challenge, to have U.S. Customs realize that they have a right to inspect at the border, but comes with that right, I guess, an obligation to make it easier for businesses to adhere to the rules and regulations. So that was probably our biggest challenge, to make sure that we could explain to U.S. Customs that you can't take a boxcar off the middle of a train and just park it somewhere so you can inspect it and then leave the next day. But that today, I think, has been worked out, and we've had good cooperation. But it goes to your comment, Derek. I think when it comes to the proposed changes about the U.S.-Canadian security perimeter, it'll be essential for the private sector to be at the table to find a way to make sure its voice is understood in a very positive fashion. I'm not trying to be an impediment to what they're trying to get done here, but it is crucial. I think so far we've seen some willingness on the part of the Canadian directorate to reach out and consult with the private sector to make sure they know what the issues are.
Because the one thing we all found out, I think, a few years ago when there was the blackout in Mid-America and large parts of Ontario and even parts of Quebec, was just how interconnected we really are in terms of electricity grids. And we've got rail lines, we've got pipelines, we've got electricity grids, and they're all interconnected. And what happens in one affects the other. So the more we're aware, and as the examples we heard earlier about NORAD and how it provided perimeter security for the Olympics, for instance, I mean, these are things that are not generally known in Canada or the United States, but there is scope for more. Any other comment on that first question from either you, Alvin, or Frank?
Well, I would just make one comment. First of all, I'm one who supports the new initiatives, both the harmonization and also the efforts at perimeter security very strongly. Secondly, I do believe that the border is thicker since 9/11. I think it's understandable as well.
Yeah.
Our preoccupation with commerce and the American preoccupation with security don't exactly fit together, but I think they can be made to fit together. And I think through the use of technology and creativity and flexibility that we can dramatically improve the ease of travel between the countries.
Good. Alvin, anything?
Only saying that I'm a Canadian. my head office is Montreal. I love Montreal. I love Canada, Quebec. But I almost see myself as an American company. I'm selling U.S. dollars to American customers, and as long as the goods are in our warehouse in St. Albans, we can service our customers.
Okay. I think I'll take one from the floor now. Please, you're up.
Thank you. Does Canadian National have an
article? Tell us who you are, please.
Oh, sorry, Dan Cameron from Ottawa.
Ottawa. Gee, I don't know if we're allowing questions from Ottawa.
From Ottawa?
Today.
I promise it's not about today's events.
Go ahead.
Does Canadian National have an Arctic shipping strategy, or is that too far out into the future?
Whoa.
Well, we used to own a railway that went from Winnipeg to Churchill, and that is pretty tough territory to operate in with permafrost and the winter. But to answer your question, we're looking at, you know, the Northwest Territories expanding, and it'll be up to us to find ways, without building an extensive railway, which would be a lot difficult to do today, to get access to those markets and working with either other shipping companies. But clearly, our strategy is to look to the north and move the goods to the south. So if we, you know, decide to do something, I don't think we'll build a railway all the way to the Beaufort Sea. But if we can get goods moving south on the railway, we'll do so by using other shippers with us.
And so I guess if the Mackenzie pipeline ever became a reality, you would have an additional reason.
Look right now, both in Quebec and Ontario, with the Ring of Fire in Ontario and Quebec, the iron ore mines. Some are served by rail, some are not. We're going to have to make a decision as a country.
Yeah.
You know, how you want to move those goods to market. A truckload of iron ore is pretty heavy versus a train load of iron ore, which is heavy, easier to move. So we're going to look at ourselves and say, you know, we're missing 100 miles here, 50 miles there. How do we best serve those customers and those mines? And that product is either moving overseas, out of Rupert or Halifax, or into the U.S. as it redeveloped its manufacturing base. So it's going to be important for Canadians to realize that time might come again to expand the railway, but it depends on what cost and how far we go.
Thanks, Sean. Back to you, Adam. You got another one?
Sure. Albert from the University of Toronto asks, in which areas of industry do you think Canadian and American companies would benefit from greater coordination across the border? And are there any areas where coordination between Canadian and American companies has been a problem?
Frank?
I don't have an answer for that. I think relationships are so, it's just, we're so integrated. I think it's right across the piece. Every part of our economy would be better off if we had better access. So I can't pick out a specific area.
Well, I'll give you one, and I already alluded to it. I mean, we have an automobile industry that was integrated even before free trade, and yet there are today more than 40 different regulatory standards affecting the manufacture of automobiles of the same brand from the same company on either side of the border. That is just nuts. And at a time when the governments of the United States and Canada are major shareholders in those companies, it makes even less sense. So if this Beyond the Border initiative is going to get any traction quickly, there is no better sector for it to start in for better coordination, more efficient manufacture than the automobile sector. These companies are afraid of free trade with Korea. A 6% tariff is what's holding off Korean imports into Canada. They're losing 6% of the value of their cars because of the inefficient regulations, obsolete regulations that we have in both countries. And so if we harmonize those, we will have more efficient manufacture on both sides of the border, and they will be better able to compete with the imports that they complain about on a regular basis. But that's not a commercial. It's just a point of view. The next question from the floor.
Hi. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Spencer Berger. I'm a student at McGill University. And this question is maybe a little bit less related to the topic. It's directed at Mr. McKenna. I was just curious as to your opinion on the proposed TSX merger with London Stock Exchange, and what you see as the cost and benefits, potential costs and benefits for the Canadian financial industry, as well as potential opportunities for attracting more direct investment.
And if you have a view on potash, Frank, you can talk about that as well.
Well, I did have a view on potash. We're advising BHP, so
well, we won't go there.
Strong view on that. I think we have to let the process unfold here. But we also, in my view, I guess, I'm a free trader and I'm a private enterpriser. But I also believe that we shouldn't be naive. I go around the world, and I can tell you right now, you would not be able to buy BHP in Australia. Today, I believe that the government of Italy shut down the potential purchase of Permalat. There was another deal in France that was kiboshed. I was in Hong Kong last week, and somebody asked me that question. He said, I think you guys are crazy. He said, you sell everything. He said, nobody in the world sells as much as you do. I'm inclined to be more openness, but I think we should have clear rules of the game, and so people know what are strategic assets and not. In this case, I think people need to have their eyes open in this respect. This deal, on the surface, looks like it's being portrayed as a merger of equals. The governance structure has it as not a merger of equals. One party has more seats than the other and has the CEO position in London. But it's the follow-on rules of governance that really are the ones people should look at, and they should decide on the deal based on that. If a second deal takes place, and all parties are already saying, yes, of course, there'll be other mergers and we'll have them right away. But if a follow-on merger takes place, the rules of governance fall away, so that the seats guaranteed to Canada fall away, and the lines of business that were supposed to go to Montreal, Toronto, Calgary, Vancouver, and so on, they all fall away as well. So the question in Quebec, I think, is, are you comfortable with this deal knowing that your derivatives business may very well be done in Madrid, that you can't guarantee it'll be in Quebec? Are you comfortable in Calgary knowing that there's no guarantee that those energy decisions might not be made in Australia? We don't know where things will go, but we do know that this agreement does not give protection for these businesses to stay in perpetuity in Canada. So, quick answer, my view is that the current exchange that we have works very well for our Canadian industry and for the niche market of resource industries from around the world that we service, and that we better be very sure that what we're getting is better before we walk away from a very good thing.
And it's not going to be part of the border negotiations. No. That's one thing we can't blame on the Americans, right? Okay. Adam, you got another one?
Yep. Got one more. This one, I think, is from Mr. Finn. It's from Jennifer in Montreal, who asks, what role did the free trade agreement play in CN's turnaround strategy?
Well, I think that because Paul Tellier was the CEO, after the IPO, very quickly realized that the growth strategy was based on NAFTA. That's where the growth would come from. You know, for 100 years, we operated a railway at a loss from east-west, and to leverage that, I think that very much in his mind, right after the IPO, started to reflect with the management team, how do we go about expanding our reach into the U.S. to benefit from the growth due to the free trade agreement? And if you look at how we've grown since then, it's been a key part of it. At the same time, we did use the agreement also when we tried to buy BNSF, and the U.S. government, through the STB, changed the rules. We invoked the fair national treatment of the NAFTA agreement, so you can't have different rules for companies which are in both countries. And even though the U.S. Canadian government was very, very forceful in its submission to the U.S. government, we didn't win the day. But I'd say to you that if we are what we are today at CN, it's very much due to the free trade agreement.
Thank you very much. Do you have any more, Adam, or you shot your bolt?
Tim Reed, again.
I can't see through the lights here, sorry.
Given what you've described as the very integrated pan-North American nature of your businesses, what would your opinions be about a currency union of some form in North America and or more formal financial regulation mechanism coordination?
That's for you, Frank.
Yeah, I think it's a really dumb idea.
Yeah.
And I don't even understand it very well, but just look at what Europe's going through right now and the inability of countries to try to respond to the particular asymmetric threats that they have because they're in a currency union. So I think that's a dumb idea.
I think that's a pretty clear answer. Okay, we've got time for one more, Ian.
Yeah. Hi there. My name is Paul Murphy, coming from Calgary. I got a question. We were talking about trucks and trains. I want to know, with energy prices rising, is there kind of a strategy we could be looking to move more towards train transport because of the cost involved.
Talk about a tennis ball.
In that?
Yeah.
And also, you know, I hate to bring this up, but you guys were once a public company. Because of the immense cost related to the infrastructure required to install a railroad system, is there any solution to those problems with energy?
Well, I think that, yes, we are a publicly traded company. We do invest, you know, almost 20% of our gross revenues back into the plant every year to make sure it's safe and we can operate. So we're not complaining about that. It's part of doing business in a high capital intensive business. And on the environment, there's no doubt that trucks are more efficient than trucks. We're training them more efficient than trucks, excuse me.
Almost got you there.
Trying to be a diplomat, Mr. Bernie, but no doubt we are
no
a bit, we are more efficient.
No plug.
The challenge will be to, you know, for the price of oil is beneficial. It is our second biggest cost component, so don't take it wrong. It's efficient, but it is a big part of what we
could
do.
Could you ship oil?
Yeah, we'd love to ship oil. Yeah. The problem is where, too. But more important, I think that
pipelines are cheaper.
We are making choices, and I think that that's one of the challenges for our industry as a whole, not just for CN, to have the average Canadian and average U.S. person realize that you can move, you know, 250 trucks on one train with two locomotives, which emissions are a lot less than oil trucks. The border being more efficient is more beneficial. So it's up to us as an industry to work with that. Now, there's a place for truckers. There's no doubt. There's not a container in Canada. Doesn't move in the first mile or last mile by truck. So let's make sure that there's a role for truckers to play with us in our business. But long distances, no doubt that we have a role to play. And I think we are more efficient from an environmental perspective. Our job is to make sure people understand that and we sell it to them.
Thank you very much.
Ian,
thank
you all. Well, if you thought the 1988 election on free trade was a tough one, Derek, imagine the election on a common currency between Canada and the United States.
Forget it.
With the opponents saying, who do you want on your $5 bill, Abraham Lincoln or Wilfrid Laurier? Yeah. How's that for a sample?
An eagle or a beaver?
And just a quick one about CN in Chicago. When this is a story that Sean likes to tell. When they were buying that small suburban railroad, they had some litigation issues. And during the transition after the U.S. presidential election, Mr. Obama, then the president-elect, commented on the case and in the press. And Hunter Harrison's response was, Obama has no standing on my case. That was a day at the office, wasn't it, Sean?
It was a tough day at the office.
Okay. Thank you for a great session. And Lauren Ramey, a McGill undergraduate poli-sci major and Canadian Studies minor, has got a token of appreciation and a word of thanks for you all.
For the Study of Canada and McGill University, I would like to thank each of the panelists today for their enlightening and informative discussion. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.